welcome back. Coming up on this week's show, we say goodbye to Diego Maradona as we share our memories of the legend. CBS opens up to share more about the studio coverage for the Champions League. What's the point of MLS playoffs? We discuss. Plus, we have letters from you, the listeners, in our mailbag section. I'm Christopher Harris, aka The Gaffer, joined alongside my co-host, Kartik Krishnayar. Listeners, if you're new to this podcast, we're your weekly guide to getting the best out of soccer viewing options from around the world, whether it's streaming, television, apps, etc. We really kind of talk more about the coverage of the game and making it as easy as possible to watch the best leagues and best teams and best players from around the world. And we really have to start off with just the devastating news. We're recording this on Wednesday night. Earlier today, hearing about Diego Maradona passing away at the age of 60. I was shocked, really, really shocked in this one, because I know that about a week ago, he had surgery on a brain tumor, but that was successful. He had looked like he was on the road to recovery. And then on Wednesday morning, I switched on, I think it was actually BBC Radio 5, wanted to hear a few minutes of pre-match for the UEFA Champions League, see if there's any team news or any stories. And I switched it on. And as soon as I switched it on, they were talking about the hand of God and the goal, from, of course, from 1986 World Cup. And I thought that was strange. I was like, why are they talking about this? This is a story we've heard a million times. It's okay. I mean, I can hear it again. And then they started talking about him in the past tense. And then I was like, whoa. And honestly, tears started streaming down my cheeks. I was completely shocked. I was not prepared for this one. Kartik, what about you? How did you find out about the news?
So I have an Argentine friend in Europe that WhatsApped me that there was a report out of Argentina that Maradona had passed away. I chose not to believe it and got very nervous, obviously. And then it was about 15 minutes later, he sends me another WhatsApp message. Hey, it's now a major newspaper in Argentina is reporting it. Then 10 minutes later, I got the BBC alert. And I had chills. I ran home. I turned on the television and watched BBC World, and they were great. I mean, these U.S. news channels are all talking about Trump and pardons and Biden and the election and all of that still 3 weeks after the election and COVID to a certain extent. But BBC World went 15, 20 minutes at the top of each half hour on Maradona and then the rest of the time on COVID. So and they got the recollections of the likes of Gary Lineker, and they had some stuff ready to go, obviously. Mm-hmm. File reports, but then a lot can't happen spontaneously. So I was watching them for actually cut into my viewing of the Man City Olympiacos match, and then was very pleased that CBS did the job they did on it, because truthfully, newer fans may not quite get this. In the history of football, I think you put their great names, right? You have players that were great, great players, the elite players in the history of the game, and you would include in this current era Messi and Ronaldo in that. And then you have these players that were also transformative players that changed the way the sport was played and had an individual impact unlike any other. Look, I never watched Di Stefano play. I never saw Puskás play. I never saw Stanley Matthews play. So I'm dated at a certain period onward. So I'll concede that at the start when I say this, because I know this will probably be controversial. There are only two players I put in the bucket of both being generationally transformative players and among the elite players of all time. And those are Johan Cruyff, who we lost a few years ago, mm-hmm. and Diego Maradona. And Maradona was the better of those two players. So I'm really sad. There's nothing else I can say about it. I mean, we should talk more about it, but it's mm-hmm. a horrible thing for this sport. And I really, 60. I know people like to talk about all the other extracurricular things with him. I don't want to talk about that. We've lost as I said, I think there were two players that that were transformative and elite, and we've lost them both in the last 5 years. And we lost them both, I think, at a relatively young age. So it's heartbreaking, I think, for so many of us. And I know you and I are not alone. It's a bad day for the sport. And again, I don't know if younger people quite appreciate his impact. But he had an unbelievable impact, not only on winning a World Cup for Argentina, but I think on transforming Serie A, the league, and changing the sport at a time when it was overly physical and overly defensive and really becoming quite dour in the 1980s. I think a large part of football surviving and thriving at this time goes back to that one player. So his impact cannot be understated.
For a lot of listeners, most of us are based in the United States. We do have some listeners. We actually have a lot of listeners from the UK and from Europe and Asia, etc. But 90% of our listeners are from the United States. And for myself, probably for you, Kartik, too, but Diego Maradona was really more of a World Cup player as far as our experience watching him on television. So, like, 1978 World Cup, he didn't make the final cut because I think Cesar Menotti thought that Diego was too young at that stage. 1982 World Cup, I was still living in Europe, but 1982 World Cup, he was one of the stars. 1986 yeah. World Cup, now I'm in the U.S., living in the U.S., and we get to experience the 1986 World Cup with Maradona, the best tournament of his entire life. Definitely, single-handedly, of course, with his teammates, won the World Cup. 1990, Maradona. 1994, he gets called into the squad late, scores, I think, that goal against Greece. And then, kind of controversy happens and he's out. But for a lot of listeners and a lot of viewers, really, we didn't get to experience Diego Maradona watching Serie A in the 80s, seeing him play for Napoli, seeing him at his height, seeing him play for Barcelona. If we would have seen those games, Kartik, it probably would have been clips, right? Or reading articles or listening to a radio broadcast talking about Maradona. To me, he was all about the World Cup, and that's in Argentina, of course, the national team, and those are my memories of him as a player. Well, as well as, of course, going back into clips and going back into watching highlights and seeing anything I could find on him. But it wasn't, Serie A, as far as I know, you didn't get to see many of those games, if any of those games, in the U.S. in the 80s.
Yeah, so the only time in my life I've been to Naples, was ironically enough because we took a family trip in the summer of 1987, and Napoli had just won the Scudetto, and Maradona had gone there. He had lifted them above Sacchi's Milan, and there were good Inter teams and Juventus teams at that time as well. So I actually experienced that. Wow. In 87, in June of 1987. Right after, late June, early July, as a 12-year-old, and I didn't know anything about Serie A. I had heard of Milan. My knowledge came from, basically who had played in the old NASL and what clubs they had come from, right? So I knew about AC Milan. I knew Van Basten and Hulett and Rijkaard. I knew those players. So that was pretty impressive. And then I didn't get to watch Serie A, right? Obviously, being back in the U.S., and you mentioned the 86 and 90 and 94 World Cups, and then obviously Maradona managed in the 2010 World Cup. But I did, as I got access to football in the 90s, European football on TV, whatever, tape delay, internet, once the internet came about, really grew an appreciation for what Maradona did at Napoli. Because again, we talk about these great players, Messi, Ronaldo of this era, and the great players of previous eras. I've talked about transformative players. I would say the most transformative players of this most recent era for me are Xavi Hernandez, and who, of course, played much of his career with Messi, and Raquel May, and also Claude Makélélé, who, of course, played for Real Madrid and Chelsea and France. But none of the guys I've talked about, other than Raquel May, they generally didn't play for clubs like Napoli that were not big, big clubs, right? Mm-hmm. And what he did to get that club to punch at a higher level and then transform Serie A, because Serie A was a very defensive, physical league in the 1980s. And in the 1980s, I think we've talked about this before on the show, and English football was terrible. It was a horrible time. The Bundesliga in the 1980s was kind of physical and very dour, a lot of 1-0 matches, a lot of 0-0 matches in Italy in the 1980s. Spain, I think, was always there were some more kind of passing principles, et cetera, in the Spanish league. But what Maradona did in Serie A was, here's a guy whose feet were like his hands, right? For lack of a better term, right? And the ball stuck to his feet.
Right.
And
technical skills.
Yeah, the technical skills were unbelievable. But more importantly, when guys, typical Serie A players, decided they were gonna try and take his legs out and plunge into him, he'd bounce off them.
Right,
which we've seen the clips at the international level of him in Argentina, but in Serie A it was even more physical, and he was able to single-handedly take a club, a mid-table club, and take him to the top. Two titles, they won the Coppa Italia once. So to me, and then Serie A becomes a more attractive league for attacking players in the 1990s as a result of Maradona's success at Napoli,
right,
and the floodgates open.
We missed all of that, though, Kartik. We missed that in the U.S.
Yeah.
Because
you
listen to Richardson on Football Weekly, and they'll reminisce about the 80s, late 80s, watching Italian football every week on Channel 4 there in the U.K.
Yeah.
And seeing the best of Serie A, seeing this gorgeous football played, you had all the best players from around the world. It was, you mean, just like today's Premier League. You had all the stars there at the highest level playing gorgeous football. And it was wonderful to watch, and as opposed to at the time English football, which was very kind of going through a very dark period.
My point would be that Italian football wasn't like that before Maradona came. Now, yeah, Hulett and Van Basten went there also, and several other guys, but I think Maradona transformed that league and made it the best league in the world.
I guess in many ways, though, too, Kartik, there's probably some listeners who are Italian Americans who were tuning in and watching RAI in late 80s in the US, probably with satellite dishes, your cafes or Italian pizzerias, or you mean just watching Maradona, watching Napoli, watching all these great teams. But for most of us, I think myself included, I mean, in the late 80s, there was hardly any soccer games on television other than indoor. And maybe there were some highlight shows now and again. Yeah, there were highlight shows. But as far as live football, you'd be lucky to find, in English, you mean one game a week, maybe one game a month.
I remember even seeing, sorry to cut you off, but I think that this kind of dates it, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but the first match I remember seeing was the FA Cup final between Spurs and Nottingham Forest in 1991, I believe it was. So I could be wrong. Maybe there was matches on before that I never saw, but that's the first match I remember actually being able to watch in its entirety on English language television. And I think it was taped delayed, but it was the same day. It was later the day. So you're right, Chris. I mean, I think we only saw highlights in that era. My analysis of Maradona at Napoli is largely based on, one, my childhood memory of going there at 12 years old and getting caught up in the frenzy that the 2 days we were in Naples. And then two, because I knew who he was right from 86, and plus, you know, we knew Argentinian people here in South Florida. And then two, just going back in the 1990s as I was getting into Serie A and piecing together what had happened in the 80s. So you're right. I didn't actually experience it firsthand sitting in the United States. I guess none of us did. You're right. I hadn't thought about it that way, but I think you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, I think some of us might have maybe, I don't know, Soccer America or World Soccer Magazine or the newspapers. You mean back there, you would have gone, you mean back in the 80s, been able to go to, you know, in big cities, go to a newspaper stand and sometimes find papers from overseas and then read about what was happening. So at the end of the day, I mean, it's still the World Cup that crystallizes my memories of Diego Maradona. And of course, you go to the 1986 World Cup, just as one example. And just that one game against England, and those two goals he scored, kind of at opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of, you mean, pure skill and pure evil on the other side, kind of the dark arts of soccer. But that's what I remember Diego Maradona for, and it's something. He's a player. He's older than both you and I, Kartik, and probably a lot of our listeners. But he was a player of our generation. You mean just as maybe so for our fathers or for some of the older listeners, Pelé was of their generation. Yeah. Just as Cristiano and Messi right now are a player of our current generation for a lot of the younger listeners. But he's going to be sadly missed for sure. And just one of the best, I mean, if not the best, especially on the technical control, just a joy to watch and a roller coaster of a career. If anyone hasn't had a chance to watch the documentary called Maradona, which was released, I think, late last year, but that's available right now on HBO Max. And also, of course, on Amazon Prime, if you want to take a look there, they have all of the World Cup documentaries. So you can go back to 1982, you can go back to 1986, and onwards to see, I mean, just this incredible player at the height of his game. And I'm sure there's a ton of Serie A coverage on YouTube and other places to see just what a diamond of a player he was. And I'm still shocked that he has passed away. And Ray Clements died like about a week ago. Yeah. This is the first player in a long time that I've shed tears about. I mean, that I was completely shell shocked when this happened. And we've seen a lot of massive legends pass away, unfortunately, in the last few years.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I we've seen a lot of people pass away. I think I was kind of sad when Alan Ball passed away. That was in 2007.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think this is the first time I've been really, really sad since then. And I include like Cruyff passing away as part of that. I mean, that was sad. But I was, like I said, I dropped what I was doing. I ran home. I chose to disbelieve the initial WhatsApp message, and then it became clear it was something was up, and then I got the BBC alert, and I ran home and just sat in front of the TV for hours, which, to be honest with you, I don't know if there's many other people that would die in my life that I revere so much that I would have done that for. I mean, it's the way people reacted when John Kennedy was shot in this country, but it was a similar feeling as a football person, and we're getting into the coverage from this weekend. I mean, it's funny, ironically enough, Jurgen Klinsmann on the pregame show for the Napoli-Milan match. And obviously Klinsmann played in that era, right? Mm-hmm. He's sort of a contemporary of Maradona's, a little bit younger. But he mentioned not having crowds and talked on the ESPN FC pregame show about what it was like to play Napoli during the Maradona era in Napoli. And that was Sunday. And no, it didn't occur to anyone that he would be dead 3 days later. So,
right. Speaking of Klinsmann, I'm not sure if you were at this game, Kartik. I know a lot about your history of going to matches, but not every match. And oftentimes, this is before I knew you. But 1993, so a year before the World Cup came to the United States, Germany played a friendly against Argentina in Miami at the Orange Bowl. And it was, I mean, the full German squad, pretty much the full Argentine squad, except Diego Maradona didn't play. I'm not sure if it was, I know around about that time he was complaining that he was kind of tired and just playing too many games, but he did not turn out that day for that game, which I think actually Germany ended up winning. But 33,000 people, I was there. Unfortunately, never got a chance to watch Diego Maradona. Would have wished he was going to be that he played in that game, but that's the closest I've gotten to see Maradona. How about you? How about you, Kartik? Were you at that one?
I was in college then. I wasn't at that game, and I never saw. I didn't get to see him play either, unfortunately. So yeah. That's the unfortunate thing, I guess, when it comes down to it. Is that never got to see him play. I'm trying to think if I've. Was that a match where he managed? I guess not.
Yeah. Well, we've got some fantastic memories of just an incredible player and a legend. Now, Kartik, this is going to surprise a lot of listeners, but in terms of what we've been watching from this past week, we're not going to go into a lot of detail, but the one match I watched that was my favorite match from this past week was a MLS playoff game, and it was a game that wasn't the prettiest of games, but just the excitement and the underdog seeing Nashville beating Toronto 1-0 in a game that Nashville completely dominated. It could have been 4-0, 5-0 if Nashville were able to convert their chances. But both John Strong and Stu Holden did a really good job of really, really getting into this game, just getting really excited and kind of sensing something major was going to happen. Of course, Toronto, usually a team that makes it all the way to the final or if not pretty close to it. In Nashville in their first season in Major League Soccer, causing a massive upset. And you mean the football wasn't the greatest, but the excitement level was really high, and that was my favorite match of this past week. So I'm rooting now for Nashville to go all the way. I mean, just playing a good brand of football, very organized, not very flashy, but a lot of players playing really well together as a team. And That's my team, I guess, from now to the end of the season in the MLS Cup to see how far they go. What about you, Kartik? Any games that you saw this past week that were, or any programming that was a highlight?
Yeah, I think that there were two games that were really, really good this weekend. The Villa Brighton match in the Premier League and the Monaco PSG match in Liga. And the Monaco PSG match has left Thomas Tuchel on the brink of being sacked. And as of this recording, he hasn't been sacked. Although, look, they came back and won the Champions League midweek, so I guess maybe he's off the hook temporarily. But Kevin Volland, who had been one of my favorite players in the Bundesliga the last few years at Bayer Leverkusen, actually had reaped the benefits of playing with Kai Havertz, particularly last season. Really, really good in this comeback for Monaco. And Liga has been interesting for me, because they're having a proper season, right? They started when they didn't finish last season, and because they're having a proper season, it feels like the football is a little better, right? They're not playing every 3 days, this sort of thing, like we're seeing in Italy and England and Spain and Germany. So I've actually tuned in more to that league the last few weeks and really, really enjoyed that game. And Bien's not in many homes, but yeah. This would have been a great game if it had been on another network for the audience. But unfortunately, it was on Bien.
Yeah, but that's the thing, though, too. I mean, Rennes midweek against Chelsea on Tuesday, they looked really good. I mean, every game I've seen Rennes play in the Champions League, they've been a really attractive team to watch. And very unfortunate that they didn't make it through to the next round. That's the thing about the French league; it's always entertaining.
Chelsea, right? I mean, they're in the group with two of the better teams in Europe, so that was just bad draw, unlucky.
Exactly. Yeah. So, what was the other match that stood out for you?
Oh, and Brighton and Villa was the other match. Okay. Those were really good matches. I think, for me this weekend.
I think I have to apologize to Jose Mourinho, Kartik. I'm completely very shocked and surprised at how well Spurs have been playing. Jose's been managing this squad. Because I think when he was hired, I was like, oh, gosh, here we go again. It's going to be Man United all over. It's going to be all about Jose's ego. It's all going to be about him and the man management and just the tactical management's going to be just, I don't know, thrown under the bus. I didn't think he had much left in him. And meanwhile, they're playing some really good football. I mean, they're really, really impressive this season. So apologies, Jose.
Pochettino left him a good team. I mean, he inherited a much better team at Spurs than he had at United. But a couple quick points about NBC in terms of Spurs. So I think Højbjerg, and I think I flagged this very early on in the season, Højbjerg was, and I loved him at Southampton the last few seasons, was a very, very significant signing. And then you pair him with Moussa Sissoko in that midfield, and you've got this two-man double pivot that is really intelligent, right? You've got two really intelligent players, which is when you think about a manager like Jose, who doesn't have a set style, but expects his players to think and think through matches. That is a perfect foil in front of a back four that isn't that good. But then going forward, Spurs have so much quality and an embarrassment of riches. I don't know why they needed Gareth Bale when they've got Lamella and they've got Lucas Moura. Lucas seems to be a player that Mourinho loves for whatever reason. But then again, Lamella's always hurt, and maybe they needed Bale to come in and push these guys.
Well, and Europa League.
Man, Europa League, right? To balance the Europa League. But NBC has not talked about what is actually making Spurs so good. Okay, we already talk about how they talk about the big six too much, right? And they don't talk about the other teams. So if you want to talk about why Villa and Southampton are having such good seasons, you're not going to get that analysis on NBC. And then with Spurs, I'm looking at how Jose is doing things this season, and they're never talking about it, right? They're talking about the easy narratives. Oh, he brought Gareth Bale in. Oh, Son is on fire, right? Son is very, very good. We know that. But not talking about the things that are less sexy and more kind of analytical related to Jose getting the Spurs team to punch at a level that they haven't previously, even under Pochettino. And then you have this sort of revolving door of analysts in the studio. They're not there for one match; they're there for the next match. I also noticed the intro for NBC's pregame show on Monday before the whichever match it was, the Burnley match,
Right.
That they had the Premier League productions opening. They used to have their own kind of canned NBC opening. So I don't know what's going on, honestly. I'm just really frustrated. And when I had their pregame side by side with ESPN, ESPN did a full on pregame show, as I mentioned, we're talking about Maradona, for Napoli and Milan. There's no comparison in terms of the conversation in the studio and what you're getting out of each show. I got a lot out of ESPN's show leading into that. And the people who know me know I'm not a huge fan of Jurgen Klinsmann as a manager, but I think he's doing pretty well in the ESPN studio. NBC, I got nothing out of their pre-match show. In fact, their pre-match show went on about all of Liverpool's injuries without acknowledging that Leicester has a bunch of players out, significant players out as well.
Yeah, the one thing that was part of NBC's success thus far with the Premier League was their consistency. So you knew which channels the games would be on, even without even thinking about it. And then you would have that even consistent lineup of talent. And I think this season in particular, we're missing Carlo Martino. Carlo Martino would be that guy that would probably be able to sit down and give you a good 5-minute deep dive into Jose, talking about the strengths and why the Spurs team is different under Jose and what he's doing right. That you don't get as much with Robbie Musto, who could go down that path but doesn't. So I don't know if that's from a producer side as far as, you mean, or short on time. But the other thing is, though, too, just the consistency or inconsistency of watching games. This past Saturday, first game was on Peacock, second game was on NBCSN, third game was on NBC, fourth game was on Peacock. So they're jumping around from platform to platform, and it's probably harder for people to catch up or stay figuring out, okay, which channel are we moving to next? Okay, let's jump to that one. Okay, this one has to go to streaming. Okay, let's jump to that one. And unfortunately, I think they've lost their mojo. I mean, we talked about this even last season. This season, absolutely, they've lost their mojo as far as everything that was good about what they've been doing. I don't know if it's cost cutting. I don't know if it's lack of resources. I don't know if it's just basically that they just don't have the energy or the excitement that they used to have. But it's nowhere near as good. Now, Lee Dixon, you mean, as far as the talent, I mean, Lee Dixon to me is probably the shining star out of everyone. Yeah. And Rebecca can be good at times, and the two Robbies can be good at times. But that's the studio side. As far as the actual commentary, Lee Dixon to me is the star of the show.
Yeah, I know we've had the Arlo White conversation a lot on this show. I don't know, and I know NBC's not going to do this because they're really invested in Rebecca Lowe, but I think about if you brought Arlo White back and you put him in the studio and you had him hosting, I think there might be it might be better. There might be more interesting questions asked. But then again, maybe it's a producer side thing. Maybe Rebecca, because Rebecca has shined in the past. Mm-hmm. It's just now it seems very, very rehearsed, very safe. And very, just very static. Well, we've talked about the static stuff, but it's also the lazy storylines connected with the top six. So it's not just that they exclusively focus on the top six. It's the very lazy storylines connected to the top six. I have noticed Tim Howard can be kind of analytical if he's pushed and if he's given time, but he doesn't have the level of analysis that we got from Martino. I mean, clearly their decision to let Martino go or whatever happened has I think made the bumper programming not worth watching. But just by removing that one person, although that's a culmination of, as I've mentioned before, a number of Steve Bauer, Neil Ashton, et cetera, a number of people leaving over the course of the 8 years they've had the Premier League. I think the final straw is Martino leaving, and there's no value to the shows anymore without him, quite frankly.
Yeah, the other thing, though, too, is that the way that the schedule has happened on any given Saturday with COVID-19 going on and with the games being staggered. So you have your 7:30 a.m. kickoff Eastern time, your 10 a.m., your 12:30 p.m., and now you have your 2:15 or 3 o'clock or 3:15 kickoff time. So in the past, while we would have had three windows, the length of their production has actually gone on. So that's why I think in some ways, for that early kickoff, for that 7 o'clock in the morning, you only have two people on. It's usually Rebecca and either Tim Howard or Rebecca and Robbie Earl. And then magically happens around about the 10 o'clock mark. Then somebody else pops in. So now you have three people. But I guess that's part of what they're doing, is rather than having everyone be there for all four of those matches staggered, they're kind of doing some time shifting and having some people come in a little bit later. It just makes it really, really weird.
And in fairness to NBC on this, no individual broadcaster that doesn't use Premier League productions for their studio programs, I think, in the world has this issue where they're showing every match. Because it's split up, packages are split up between BT and Sky.
Yeah, good point.
I guess we have to cut NBC some slack on that. That they're having a block of four matches on, oftentimes on both Saturday and Sunday, back to back to back to back. That having been said, this also coincides with them downsizing. So they would have probably been able to handle it a few years ago. I forgot to mention, they had Gary Lineker working with them the first few years, which was such a treat for American viewers. So they've lost Lineker, they've lost Bauer, they've lost Ashton, they've lost Martino, and they haven't replaced any of these people. And now they're forced to show more matches on linear television, or they have to have studio shows around more matches, whether it's on linear television or on Peacock, than ever before. And it's just it's showing them up, unfortunately.
All right, let's move on to TV streaming news. And not a lot of news this week, but I did get a chance to interview the top producer from CBS Sports, senior creative director Pete Radovich, and to talk to him about the UEFA Champions League and talk about the production, talk about some of the changes they've made, talking about Jamie Carragher and Roberto Martinez, etc. Just trying to get a better understanding of how that all came together. So I have a clip from that interview. The full article, actually there's two articles, are on the homepage of worldsoccertalk.com, so you can read those there for more in-depth perspective. But I'm going to play a clip here from Pete Radovich, where I ask him about the coverage and how that studio coverage came together and how they've been able to really kind of tap into some really good chemistry in that studio. So let me go ahead and play that clip for you so you can get some perspective on that.
I think I'll tell you real quick a story. Like, I'm really proud of the fact what we did day one. When we had 2 days of rehearsals. Mm-hmm. And literally day one, when everyone came in the same room together, got into the same room, one filed it one after the other, a few minutes after each other, and we were going to have our meeting brief. And Peter Schmeichel showed up last. And him and Jamie started going at it right away. And then Michael jumped in. And I'm, you know, we're supposed to be having a meeting talking about, all right, this is what we're doing. And we let them go, I think, for easily over an hour, where they just were talking, having fun, joking, laughing. And at some point, someone turned to me, maybe it was Kate, and said, all right, that was enough. Let's see, you want to get going? And I remember saying, that's the show. Mm-hmm. You guys just did. That's it. Like, forget about what I'm going to give you. You don't need me. What you guys just did on your own is the show. You guys all like each other. You have a chemistry. You have fun with one another. That's the show. We're throwing some football, but that's the show. Like, we'll format and all that. But those 2 days, we were, you know, rehearsals because we had to see him on camera. We wanted to see, you know, sort of block where, who's going to sit where. Mm-hmm. But really, those 2 days were designed for them to just hang out.
Yeah, so there you go. So that's the clip from the interview with Pete Radovich. And to hear, or actually to read more insights in terms of how he compares also the coverage of the Champions League on CBS Sports compared to how it is on UK television. Of course, because the studio is based in London, he's working out of London, and just some of his thoughts about the differences between broadcasting for UK television but then broadcasting here for US television through CBS Sports. So some good insight into how things are put together there. All right, let's move on to TV ratings. Kartik, there's some interesting numbers here because we have some numbers from both the Liga MX playoffs. We also have the numbers from some of the Premier League matches we've been mentioning, and also the MLS playoffs. The Spurs against Man City game on Saturday, which is on NBC and Universo, this one had almost 1 million viewers. It had 991,000 viewers, which was the most watched match from this past week. This past weekend. Then you had Chivas against Necaxa, 971,000 viewers for that on Telemundo, so on and so forth. The MLS numbers, actually, some of them were good, Kartik. Philadelphia against New England on ESPN, 478,000 viewers. Seattle against LAFC on ESPN, this was Tuesday night, 457,000 viewers for that. Toronto against Nashville, 240,000 viewers. And then you had some ones that were really disappointing. New England against Montreal, 108,000 on FS1, as well as Nashville against Miami, which was 129,000 viewers on that Friday night game on FS1. The question I have, Kartik, about MLS playoffs is, I was thinking about this a little bit deeper today, and I was thinking, like, why does MLS insist on still doing the playoff system? Because we look at the TV viewing numbers, and yes, they're decent, but they're not out of the park. I mean, you would think that the way that the league is structured, where you have the regular season and then the playoff numbers would be through the roof. It would be almost like kind of World Series or NFL playoffs, that those numbers would be massive numbers, and that would be the reason why you would stick with a playoff system. But what for you, why do you think that they stick with the playoff system as kind of the format for the league?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think they're trying to keep relevance for the regular season, because I'll tell you this, from a marketing and ticket sales standpoint, the MLS playoffs have been a problem for a lot of clubs that are not able. You find out when you're playing and you have to turn around the matchup a week later. So it's tough to, and it's not part of your season ticket package. So, and there are some exceptions to that, but generally you have to resell. And if you have MLS teams have great sales forces, right? They have 30, 40, sometimes people in there, depending on the club, on their sales team, but it's tough to sell tickets that quickly. So the ticket advantage isn't there. Generally, obviously this season you can't look because of COVID, but generally the attendance for playoff games, the average is lower than for the regular season. Then you've got the situation with the television ratings, which you've mentioned. So I don't know why they keep going with playoffs. I mean, it's just maybe a cultural thing, but you could put a premium on the playoffs if you had four teams or eight teams, but then you make most of your regular season irrelevant without promotion and relegation. So I think that's the balancing act, right? That they're having a hard time with that,
right?
And I don't know what they do. You could argue they make the regular season more relevant if they cut the playoffs down to four teams or six teams, But then there will be a ton of dead rubbers because there'll be another solution could be to split the season and have a spring season and a fall season, but they seem resistant to doing that also. That's what makes the Mexican Liga MX playoffs and actually Liga MX itself very interesting, is the split season to me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, me too.
And Argentina, same thing. I mean, a number of the leagues in Latin America, but Mexico in particular, since that's the league I watch the most from that has that format, I think is much more interesting because they do that. So then things reset. So there's always relevance then.
Yeah, I agree, Kartik, too. I think that the Mexican playoff system could be something with a split season, could be something that works well for Major League Soccer in the future. I think originally it was intended, I mean, when they came up with the system for MLS and decided not to go with promotion relegation and to set up a kind of a single entity, I mean, all the teams, there's no teams get relegated. How do we make this meaningful? Let's go ahead and add playoffs. And I think basically the onset of this was really kind of thinking more from a NFL or a baseball perspective, saying, okay, you mean this? Let's create this to be. This is our brand. This is our soccer. This is our American soccer. Let's go with that. But now, though, I think it is very cultural. In that, you mean the way the system, that it's a very American system, but it's one of those things that at the end of the day, you can look at the numbers and go, okay, well, actually, the numbers show otherwise. The numbers show that the playoffs aren't a massive hit. So why are we sticking with it? I honestly believe that one of the reasons they're sticking with it is because it's easier to sell to sponsors and advertisers. If they go into Budweiser, or go into any major brands in the United States that are interested in advertising, and they explain how Major League Soccer works, it's just like the NFL. It's just like the World Series of baseball. Yeah. It's something we have our regular season, but the playoffs, that's when it gets really exciting. And at the end of the day, the number one reason, I think, is that MLS wants to have their own Super Bowl. Now, the MLS Cup isn't, the final is a big event, but it's nowhere near Super Bowl level. But that's the intention. I think that's what, when they went into this thinking originally, let's have the playoffs and let's make this into the Super Bowl of soccer in the US. Well, a lot has changed since the late 90s as far as globalization, about being able to watch soccer from around the world. We were talking about earlier in this podcast about Diego Maradona not to have the ability to actually even see many of his club games in action, only seeing him every 4 years. And that was kind of the mindset at that time, as far as, okay, let's have Major League Soccer and let's make that the Super Bowl of soccer. Now, 2020, that's a whole different story. So I think right now, I think it is cultural. And I think it's easier to explain it to advertisers and sponsors and to mainstream America what it's all about. But at some time, maybe the Liga MX playoff system is something that they can kind of dovetail into and change it and make the system better so that the actual regular season games are more meaningful.
Yeah, so a couple of thoughts on that. I think you're right. They based it on the NFL and then the NHL and NBA for years. Almost every team made the playoffs in those sports. I don't think it's as much based on baseball, because I'm not a baseball fan anymore, and I understand the playoffs have been expanded, et cetera, in baseball. I don't know how many teams get in now. But at one time, it was very hard to make the playoffs in baseball. I mean, it was just the best of the best that made it. And effectively, you could have some really good teams, the teams that would be the second or third best team in the league, not make the playoffs. So I don't think they based it on baseball. Baseball wanted to keep the playoffs small, and there were a lot of traditionalists because that would make there's 162 games in baseball, but it made all those regular season games meaningful, because until the mid-1990s or late 1990s, only four teams made the playoffs in baseball of the 26 or 28 teams they had at the time. And then I know then they expanded it to six teams making the playoffs, and now I think it's 8 or 10, something like that. So, but for a long time, it was very difficult. It was almost like qualifying for Champions League out of top European league. It was very difficult to qualify. I think it's more based on the NFL, where they let all these teams into the playoffs, and then they have the one big game at the end, right?
Right.
The one-off, which they can build a whole weekend around, which is what they've done with the MLS Cup. And the same thing with the All-Star game, right? That's a very American concept, mm-hmm. Of having this midseason match, and that comes from baseball, actually. That is where they borrowed from baseball, and then the NBA, of course, does it too, where the NHL, where they have this All-Star game, and they would have all these events around it. In fact, I think we remember when the All-Star game was in Orlando in the late 90s, and they had a whole All-Star weekend and Wide World of Sports. And
yeah. Even last year, with Atleti in town.
I'm thinking back in the day.
Okay,
right. They had like skills contests, and they had all of this other stuff going on at Wide World of Sports. While they had the game at the Citrus Bowl on a Sunday, I think Friday and Saturday there were events all day. So, and now it's a midweek game, so they do it like Tuesday and Thursday. I think as you have more soccer media that's versed in the way things are in Europe, these things fade in importance. MLS Cup is a one-off match. I don't have an objection to that, but I think the drawn-out playoff structure to get the MLS Cup is a little bit cumbersome and, quite frankly, difficult for a lot of teams. If Seattle hosts games or Portland hosts games or Toronto, they can sell, right? And they've generally been the teams that have done very well in the playoffs recently. But if you have Dallas hosting a lot of playoff games – or Chicago hosting a lot of playoff games, it's very difficult for those clubs to sell tickets. It's very difficult for those clubs to get the news, the media coverage in their local markets at that time. Mm-hmm. So it's fraught with all kinds of danger. And we saw what happened the year that Colorado played Dallas in the final, that it ended up being this just absolute disaster. So,
right.
But then when they get Seattle playing Toronto, which they've gotten more often than not lately, or Portland in the final, then it's a big event.
Yeah, most of the playoff games I've seen so far in the last week or so have been good. They've been entertaining. One of the issues that they have is that they're clashing at the same time as not only NFL games, but more importantly for me and a lot of listeners is soccer games. So last Saturday, Orlando against NYCFC. I'm watching the game, watching the period of extra time. And added extra time, and then it's 3 o'clock, and Atleti are playing Barcelona, the game of the weekend, the one that I want to watch. So I switch over and started watching that game. Meanwhile, I missed the penalty kicks, the whole wild drama that happened with that, the fiasco. But that's the challenge they're up against: is that there's so much going on, whether it's NFL football or other sports, that it's a difficult time of the year to actually be playing these games anyway. It's something that I think MLS needs to consider and at some point needs to change, and just for the betterment. I mean, the other thing too about this, the whole playoffs too, is that pretty much I think every single game of Inter Miami this season I watched. So home and away, watched it on streaming or television. They were absolutely horrible. A really, really poor team. Amazingly, in the last game, they make it into the playoffs. So they have their one playoff game against Nashville, and they lose. Now, Philadelphia, who had an incredible season, who won the Supporters' Shield, they enter the playoffs, they play one game, and they're out. So Philadelphia, so how does that give meaning to the season when you have a team that's been so bad that plays the same number of games in the playoffs? Yes, there was a play-in playoff for Miami, but then Philadelphia, of course, they could have won that game and gone on, but they lost that game. So to me, it makes the whole regular season less meaningful. I mean, why should I bother watching the actual regular season if it has very little meaning in the actual playoffs? If anything, if it worked in Philadelphia's as a disadvantage, skipping around and going in cold and not having played a game in a couple of weeks and playing New England and losing that match. All right, let's move on to listener mailbag. First up is Curtis Williams. Curtis says, my personal memory of Diego Maradona was 34 years ago during the World Cup in Mexico, 1986. I was a junior in college when I saw Maradona play on Spanish language television along with other college students in Little Rock. His hand of God goal against England was fantastic, but his running past 6 England players before scoring made me fall in love with the beautiful game, regardless of the spoken language. Tony Torrado was on the call then for Univision at that time, and for me, Diego Armando Maradona will always be the best athlete of my generation, period. Rico Richardson says, it really makes no sense to even compare the MLS playoffs with Liga MX playoffs. Primarily, Spanish media markets favor Liga MX, so those numbers will be fine. MLS still has college football games, plus MLS doesn't promote their games. Don Dickerson says, the issue with Nations League, just like with any other league, is that we only discuss the top teams. I, for one, was glued last Wednesday to the first half of the Russia-Serbia match when Serbia took the monster lead going into halftime. I immediately turned to Hungary against Turkey for their second half. The joy and the frustration for those four fan bases would have been fascinating to watch, but with no fans in the stands, we don't know. Knowing Russia was going to lose and thus making Hungary the winner of the group with a win or draw, Turkey the winner of the group with a win or draw, would see them stay in the same group level of a loss, would then go down. All the possibilities happened where we not only got Hungary moving up, but Turkey moved down and Serbia with the Hail Mary will stay in League B. Tell me again how Nations League doesn't matter. Yeah, and Don, I disagree when you say that the issue with the Nations League is that we only discuss the top teams. I think I mentioned last week, too, talking about Wales and how the Nations League, what it meant to them and to me and to the history of Wales never qualifying. The last time qualifying for a World Cup was 1958, before I was born, long before I was born. And the Nations League gives Wales, a relatively small country, it is a small country, population and size, and gives them a chance. So I think in many ways, yes, the Italy's, Belgium's, England's, Germany's, Spain, oftentimes are the ones that a lot of people talk about. But I think there's a lot of us that are watching these smaller countries and these more competitive games where there is more on the line.
There is more on the line, but I don't think it has quite the meaning to the fans. I don't think fans of Russia are that concerned that they got relegated. And obviously we saw Germany got relegated and they didn't get relegated. But I think as it develops the culture, there'll be that. But it's not the same thing as a club getting relegated, because you still and sometimes strategically it's good to be in a lower pot. In terms of then if you potentially have a second chance of qualifying. But yeah, there have been some very exciting Nations League matches. I mean, in fact, I think the last set of matches, the last match day of the first Nations League was really exciting to me. The England-Croatia match, yeah. The Germany-Netherlands match, and a few others. It's a couple of them in League B also and League C, but then they reformatted the tournament after that. So we'll see. Well, I think it'll gain some acceptance as time goes on. My objection to it is just in a COVID year where I don't think people should be crossing national boundaries except in really important circumstances. And you already have a congested calendar. That's my problem with it.
Stefan follows up and says, I'm a fan of La Liga, thus I'm a Fanatis subscriber. One thing I used to enjoy is when a La Liga match was a bit of a bore, I would flip the channel over to whatever Segunda Division match was playing. Yet so far this season, beIN Sports hasn't shown any of the matches, nor does it look like they are being shown on beIN Sports Extra. Do you know what has happened to the rights? So I reached out to beIN Sports to get some more information and no response. So it looks like they no longer have the rights and it looks like nobody actually has picked them up. I did a little bit of research and YouTube, their official YouTube channel for the La Liga Smart Bank is the sponsor. But La Liga Smart Bank has highlights available, usually I think the day after. So you can still watch highlights of those games, but it's not the live thing. So if I hear anything more, I'll let people know through worldsoccertalk.com. Last but not least, Robert says, some good games and real upsets from the MLS playoffs. Nashville has been a surprise. They hammered Miami last week and did the same to Toronto. Well coached and built from the back, not the usual spend big for forwards and end up with a Keystone Cup defense like Colorado the other day. It could be another cup for Seattle Sounders. This possible early release of COVID vaccines may be what saves Major League Soccer. Another year without fans would be a disaster. hope you all have a very nice and safe Thanksgiving. Yeah, and actually, on behalf of World Soccer Talk, Kartik and I, we'd like to wish everyone a happy Thanksgiving, no matter where you are around the world, of course, of the United States, for Thursday. But in regards to Robert's comment, Kartik, I mean, this is the thing about the vaccines. Very positive news, right? Stock markets are going up. A lot of positivity now about these vaccines, and hopefully they'll be available at some point in the near future. But the issue is, you've got 10 billion people that you need to vaccinate. And how long does it take to go ahead? And I think that they have it staggered so that certain groups will get the vaccines first. So that's good news in terms of hopefully different cities, different regions, different states, kind of once the vaccine's available, is opening things up and letting larger numbers of people go to attendances for games, as one example. But how fast that happens, and depending on which state it is, depending on which country, right? Canada is still very, very tight in terms of their restrictions. It still could be a while before we get some big attendances in Major League Soccer.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think people are talking kind of wildly now about the timeline on this, and it's great to see the progress, and that's something that's really encouraging. But I think we're still looking at next year being effectively a wash for much of next year, or what would be next season in the U.S. leagues. So they have to plan accordingly.
Yeah, and that's the tough thing too. We talked a few weeks ago about possibly the MLS season starting later. Then there was follow-up reports saying that they were planning on starting it in March. That still could change, of course. Nothing's been set in stone yet. But a lot of this depends on the timing. And also, again, to the different, whether it's county governments or cities or states, and the restrictions that they have in place, and how quickly they remove some of those restrictions. It's going to be a very difficult year for Major League Soccer in 2021 anyway. We know from last week there were layoffs, some massive layoffs at Major League Soccer headquarters. A lot of staff were let go. And I think for 2021, there's going to be similar situations, not just for Major League Soccer, but probably for other leagues too.
And a lot of clubs have laid off staff. I can tell you that from just my personal network, that a lot of MLS clubs and some of the clubs that you would think as the more successful clubs have had to lay off staff, which is very, very unfortunate.
Yeah. Yeah, for Major League Soccer, I mean, really the thing that's really been the difference here is the expansion fees. A lot of these new cities coming on board and paying these large sums of money to get teams added in the near future. And without knowing the financials, I mean, I'm sure that's a huge component of Major League Soccer in terms of right now, especially with attendances really, really small and not being able to actually maximize that. All right, listeners, we want you to have your say. We want to get your opinions about anything we've talked about today, or any questions you may have about watching soccer on television and streaming, etc. And you can always reach us via email through web@worldsoccertalk.com, as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, and on Twitter @worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can always post your comments on worldsoccertalk.com. And Kartik, where can they find you on Twitter if you want to catch up on your I was going to say rants and raves, but maybe to wish you a happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, KKFLA737. My DMs are open, so anytime you want to talk with me, just send me a DM.
And actually, Kartik, we forgot to do one thing. We forgot to look at this weekend schedule to go ahead and pick out some games that we think that would be a must watch. For me, it really has to be Sunday and the Premier League, of course, and Chelsea against Spurs. I mean, especially after the game, Chelsea's game this on Tuesday against Rennes, really pulling out like a late victory there. Giroud with a fantastic, amazing header to win this game. So Chelsea against Spurs, 11:30 on Sunday, live on NBCSN and Telemundo. So that one I'm really looking forward to. Of course, there's the Jose factor, having been in previous coaching at Chelsea. But what about you? Anything stands out?
That match was the one that I felt like
I stole it from you.
Yeah, because that's first off, there's become this new element where both Arsenal fans, maybe it's not so new, but it's now more pronounced than ever, and I think it's because Jose's at Spurs, so everybody is comfortable saying this. Both Arsenal fans and Chelsea fans are like, well, we hate Arsenal fans hate Chelsea and Chelsea fans hate Arsenal, but we both hate Spurs more. And that the Jose factor contributes to that, although I think already their fan bases are already more focused on Spurs. Then you've got the fact that this Chelsea team still, to me, seems very unsettled, even though they're winning and they're scoring a lot of goals. There's just something that is not comforting to me in watching them. I think, obviously, Ziyech coming back fit has been a big addition, and we knew he would be, right? We've seen him previously at Ajax, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But I think what's to me not comforting is that it doesn't feel like they're in control of matches. And they have a very good goalkeeper. They've upgraded the goalkeeper position. Getting Thiago Silva as a stopgap has really helped them. But I'm just fascinated with what Jose is doing with this first team. And this is a chance to really lay down a marker. Last season, they struggled with Chelsea. They had an opportunity to catch them a couple times for fourth when they played them and fell short. So he's going to want this one, Jose. And the thing we're seeing is Jose has, in this era of everybody having a style, right, and a set way of playing, Jose has this ability to still come up with a tactic for a single match to negate the other side's strengths, and more often than not, his side can pull it off.
Mm-hmm.
So I expect a Spurs victory.
And that was the thing, too, that Spurs-Man City game last weekend, was that Ola White and Lee Dixon, quite a few times actually during that broadcast, were almost apologizing for Spurs playing some, basically parking the bus, right? Or just playing very, very, not parking the bus.
They scored a goal in like the second minute, so that's just natural. That's
right,
anyway.
Right. But yeah, and that's the thing, though, too. I think in many ways, I had no problem with the way that Spurs were playing. They were playing to win, but playing to conserve that lead, and weren't opening themselves up. And to me, I don't think you have to apologize for that. But I think Arlo was probably expecting a more exciting game.
Yeah, sorry, Chris. Particularly against a team like Manchester City that is utterly predictable and doesn't have any match winners in the squad right now. Unless De Bruyne beats you by getting a free kick in position. They're a club that cannot score against better teams from open play. And if they score, they'll score one goal. They're not going to score two. So, you shouldn't apologize if you're Jose. I mean, they got the early goal, and you know Manchester City doesn't have two goals in them unless you get a guy sent off or, as I said, you give De Bruyne an opportunity from a dead ball situation to score. So I thought it was played perfectly by Jose. Now, again, you got that analysis during the match from Arlo White and Lee Dixon. You did not get that analysis in the NBC studio, which was, again, goes back to, I think, my disappointment, your disappointment, and the disappointment of a lot of fans in what we've seen transpire with NBC the last, year and a half, that things have kind of gone downhill.
All right, so we will be back next Thursday for the next episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast. Thank you for listening, and no matter where you are, we hope you enjoy your football this weekend.